Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Today is Wednesday. It's March 6th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. My name is Hezzy Eris. I'm your host today. And hopefully our guest will be able to call in. Her name is Alyssa Perez. She's going to speak to us about her concerns regarding the environment and the basis for her sensitivity and how her political posture has been translated into her studies and her lifestyle, as well as the work that she does. So we're going to try to put all that together and look at someone who has been informed by science, informed by giving birth to a child, and informed by her studies. And it's a very, very compelling story because I'm sure she recognizes that all of those different facets of her life speak to her belief systems and her educational background, and also her motherhood and what she intends to bequeath. Other than, you know, the child that she bore. But the legacy of her interest and her concern is going to evidently live on by her work and by her study and by her child and by her contribution. So it's going to be very, very interesting. Now, not everyone will agree with every aspect of her being and what she believes in, but that's not the issue. I think the issue is, of course, to some extent, the validity of her thinking. But what's more compelling is that her belief system is such that she does believe all of this, and she lives that belief system, and she hopes to move it forward. And she has, evidently, a lot sooner than many people may even consider contemplating or having accomplished. And people are still talking about possibly, is this the right thing? Is this the wrong thing? Is climate change a political statement? Is it so politicized that it's not scientific? There's so many issues that are brought forward. But at the end of the day, I don't think that a lot of people are certain where it is. I don't remember specifically, but I have an inkling that goes back to a time when a scientist, I think the scientist was in China or in Korea, who stipulated that he stipulated a paper, a scientific paper, which turned out months later to be false. Because it was based on false facts and false entries. Basically, what this scientist did was he conjured up, concepts, ideas, and outcomes based on what he believed would be validating and corroborating evidence to bring his concept forward. And that had to do with that there was climate change, but it was proved to be incorrectly done and constructed. So scientifically, it was a failure, and it was said to be. And when that happened among the world, and that one scientist became the focus to undermine the whole concept of global warming. Again, whether true or not, we don't know. For some people who have no clue, other people are fixed to one side of the political spectrum and or another. But the question is, should this be a political issue? Why is it? Why did it become a political issue? Is money a contributing factor to why there's an interest for some to say that there is global warming and others to say it's not? Who's protecting what? What fiefdom do they sit upon that if things change and we start to believe that climate change is definitely there, Will that change the dynamic of business and work standards and demand for new educated population to deal with these concerns? So it's a very complex issue, and I was hoping that our guest would show, but evidently, for whatever reason, even though we reminded them of the broadcast yesterday, they may have just simply forgotten, or probably more likely something happened and they just couldn't make the broadcast, and whatever it is actually deflected them from even thinking about the broadcast. So what we're going to do then is we're going to move on, and we're going to talk about some international and local news, and hopefully you'll find that worthy. And we'll try to find somebody else who believes in some of these concepts. If you want to read her letter, she wrote a letter to the editor, Twin Green New Deal Resolutions, and written by Alyssa Perez. And or you could just put in Alyssa Perez on the Yonkers Tribune search engine. So Alyssa Perez, Perez. And you can read her letter. And it's very short, but there's a lot of meat, so to speak, even though that might be the wrong thing to do or to say. So whether it be vegan meat or just regular meat, whatever it is, there's a lot of, I don't know, something special there. There are ingredients that make this a compelling read, and it's more complex than one would think. All right, let me just take one last look. Oh, maybe that's her. We'll see. Good morning, caller. This is Hezzy.
Hey, good morning. This is Alyssa.
Hi, how are you? I'm glad you were able to make it because I was just about ready to move on to some other issues. But thanks for making the time. I read your letter to the editor, and I found it very, very compelling. You didn't hear the first few minutes, but that's all I've been discussing. Your focus and your article. But what informed you of all these things? Was it your study of science and climate change?
You know,
was it?
That's a really good question. I've gone through a lot of different types of studies in my life. When I first started college, I used to study biology. And at that time, I thought it was like the thing for me. I wanted to get into pre-veterinary medicine, but I wasn't 100% sure. And what I was doing up until I interned at an emergency animal hospital, where it wasn't quite the opportunity I thought it would be. And it turned out I didn't have the heart for it. And so I'm also a mother. And once I became a mom, I started thinking about the world I was leaving to my son. And it meant so much to me to be able to, be able to think more about it in, in a multifaceted way. Because when you think about environmental science, it comprises of so many different fields of science that you actually have to know a lot about a lot to be able to fit it into this little box of one definition of what is environmental science.
And I hear you, but I want to ask you then, so you were really informed about the direction you were going to because of the birth of your son, rather than something that you learned before or some other dogma that you may have heard about. So this is the direction you wanted to move to, is something to protect your son's future, especially
yeah.
with respect to the environment. That's a very
yes,
compelling
exactly.
thing.
I mean,
so you
it
weren't,
also has
you
to
weren't
do with
born,
a lot of
you know,
my upbringing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was just
Go ahead,
right.
Sorry.
I was always one of those kids that was, in the dirt and trying to study rocks based on just, what I could tell about, the physical characteristics. And it was a very curious child, so that added to the curiosities of, the world that was going on around us. I had a natural one at that.
So before you even became a mother, you were thinking about these issues?
Absolutely, yeah. For instance, I would always think about, my favorite thing is trash. I know it sounds funny,
okay,
but I always think about where things would go and how come we had this notion of there's an away when we tend to throw things away, because there really isn't
mm-hmm.
one that doesn't exist.
Right. There's no way to throw trash someplace and forget about it because it's
right.
always there. Okay. And did you learn this at your parents' home, or did you learn this while you were going to school? Do you recollect what was the catalyst that brought you toward that thinking?
It's definitely something that has been brought up in school, but it's certainly something that I've on my own.
Okay. And then so do you see that climate change has been politicized? How does one make a decision that climate change is a science and that it's proven, whereas other people think it's not a science and it's not proven? How did you find truth in your study and in your moving in that direction?
Well, it's really hard because the sciences and the information that's absolutely necessary to understand climate change and its completion, it's
yeah.
something that you kind of have to go to school for. And one thing that I've always wanted to do within my life, or at this time in my life, is make climate change more readily acceptable by making the information more accessible so that people can make the decision for themselves. But I think the reason why it's not so easy to accept is because in our everyday lives, on a daily basis, we don't see how we're contributing to something so large. We don't see ourselves as individuals, as a part of this bigger picture, of this bigger puzzle. We don't see how our one minor behavior can contribute to this major, large thing that humanity is going to be suffering from, or the globe, rather.
Right. I remember when I was growing up and this whole concept of climate change came about, it became almost immediately politicized. I was mentioning this in the first 5 minutes. I remember there was a scientist, I think he was a scientist from South Korea, who evidently concocted these principles and concepts and ideas that to prove that there was no climate change, but he didn't use scientific methods, he concocted them. And then once that was learned, and then it became political, and because one person did a falsehood, it wouldn't be the first scientist to break rules and regulations and standards, but it became political. And I was always taken aback at how is it that people could make a judgment call on something they did not know and based it on a political concept. And so I never understood how they could rationalize their opinion. And should it have been ever an opinion? It's either scientific or it's not. Has the science
right.
caught up with making that decision yet? Or are we still, are all the facts still not in? The science continues, doesn't it?
It's definitely a continuous thing. Now, the thing
uh-huh.
is, the science is all there. It's absolutely all there. There's nothing that
okay.
can be denied at this point. The only thing that holds, I want to say, certain people back is just that there's a missing link. There's something that they just haven't made the connection with yet.
Uh-huh. And do you
and
know what that
of,
might
you
be?
Know, for everyone, it's different. Because remember, as I said
okay.
earlier in this call, that environmental science is a science that comprises of other sciences. And it's a multifaceted
right.
thing, or a discipline. And it's even for me, there are times when there's something I haven't quite thought of when I thought that I thought of it all.
I
so
wonder,
you know, for
everything
everyone,
in
it's
life,
different.
Okay. Well, for everyone in life, they stand on one side of the, I guess, pendulum or another, somewhere along that pendulum, and quite often the direction that they take is based on money, And was there something about this whole concept of thinking about climate change coming about and becoming evident to a lot of scientific minds? Was that a money thing? Was there a reason why? Did some people feel threatened if we would come up with this concept that said, yeah, climate change is happening?
Yeah, I think that's a good point you bring up, and I definitely wanted to bring it up earlier where big thing that limits people, I want to kind of say politicians, and just like people who are big business owners, you know, when it comes to making decisions in your business, you know, climate change has a lot to do with economics. And the reason why is because it's literally fueled, you know, pun intended, by fossil fuels, and part of why climate change is happening at this time. So when you think of big businesses and corporations and even politicians, when they're trying to make decisions for, you know, the majority, it's not always the majority, sometimes about where the money is and who they're getting money from and where they're putting their buck into.
Well, that's a good point. It is not always about the majority. It's about their interests. There are a lot of things that are not specifically aligned with the public interest, and it goes in the other direction because politicians have something to protect. Their power and their control over things. So, in a sense, I get the impression when I talk to you that the most important issue for you was that you recognized in the birth of your child, of your son, that it was important for you to, to make the study and to leave him a legacy of going in the right direction, because you had the scientific proof that validated your thinking. And you didn't want to leave him in a world where the air was polluted and the water was polluted, and when these things could conceivably be changed now or delayed so that they're not as bad as they can become. Do you see an interest going in that direction? Do you think we're moving there?
I think that environmental science is something that's changed. I'm 20 years old, and when I started college, I was 17, and at that time, there weren't as many programs or majors that were offered that could give me the type of education that I'm getting now with the program at Queens College studying environmental science. So that being said, you can tell right off the bat that there's a lot more people who are interested in this field, for it to be more popular, for it to be trending too.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing's very compelling is that, in a sense, in your early life, you know, as you were growing up and you matured to an adult, and the point is that you didn't have all these things in your mind necessarily, but that you moved in that direction. And what made you recognize all of this stuff? Because you created a life for yourself in your business. You got a website called StayBlooming.com. So you live that life in your work. You live your life in your study, and you live your life for your child. How did you marry all that so quickly?
You know, it's hard to say. I always tell people it's always been a very intuitive, innate thing for me. I really enjoy it. It's my passion. Just like as I've said, it's a multifaceted thing. There are times where I can think about an issue we're having, and it's so easy for me to think of all the different reasons why we have these issues. And it's a natural thing for me. It's not something that I think school had to give me the passion for. School maybe motivated me because I have the right tools to now teach people, but it was definitely something that was just waiting to happen. This was something I think I've always been destined to do. It might sound funny, but I definitely have always felt like I had a bigger purpose And I've found it in being the environment.
Okay. So, you know, you're very driven by this, you're passionate, but you also have a capacity to grasp a lot of concepts. Is that what I hear you saying? It's almost like intuitive. I mean, you think about it, and it just clicks, and it's right, and you also work to prove it. So it's all there. It's like a complete picture. Do you find that more people are thinking along those lines? Or do you find more people in school that are studying these disciplines, and other mothers are sensitive as well because they're concerned about their children's future? And so how do you see all this? Or are we still battling this politically?
Well, I mean, we're definitely still battling it politically. I mean, it's obvious with the Green New Deal. And as far as people that I tend to put myself around, like, I don't think that it being grasped as a multifaceted thing is there yet. I still think that there are people who, you know, like, they might be advocates, like activists for the environment, but they may not be like vegans. And it's not to say with being one thing you have to be another, but if you really did understand the concept of being an environmentalist, you would understand that veganism promotes to the meat industry, and doesn't promote it, it promotes less to it. So it's like with less meat, you know, you're contributing less carbon dioxide and methane, which are greenhouse gases. And those things are what are very, very correlated to climate change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But people don't normally see that, do they? They don't think about
They don't. And, you know, I kind of don't blame people for that because it's a bit harder to understand.
Uh-huh.
And I think the direction humanity needs to move in is not so much like making smarter people of us, but just making some of this information some like more common sense to us than it's been. I mean, we are in a different age, in a different era.
Mm-hmm.
You know, technology has given us so much. And, you know, just to really answer your question, I think a lot of people are comfortable in what we've been used to receiving and giving and doing for each other, for our world, for our jobs, you know, that we don't understand that the change that we need to make is so radical and it's so different than what we're used to. And that's the very reason why less and less people want to make the change. They like their comfort.
Yeah. So that's it, really. It's a comfort zone that people are comfortable with, and that's where they want to reside. And they don't need the challenges that may require them to think of a vegan lifestyle, assuming they even know that there is such a thing. They don't realize that cows give off methane gas, and that's not good for the environment. And there's so many other things that are intertwined. Is science doing a good enough job, though, in explaining this, or why is science reluctant? Are they also under the thumb of politics?
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny because I personally believe that sometimes with scientists, like, they tend to be a certain type of person that politics isn't so much their thing. They're kind of, you know, science is science. Science is always based on fact. And politics, it can be based on fact, but it's not always a fact. Sometimes it is based on a general opinion of a majority or, you know, someone following personal interests. So I think that's really where the line can be drawn between the two, because you would like to believe that politics are facts and what, you know, but it's really more of what you see is what you get unless there's some change.
Right.
Science,
what
not
about
so much.
Like some, right. I did notice, for example, recently that I guess the scientific world has been able to produce a vegan like chopped meat, looks like chopped meat, and I guess it must taste pretty good, and it just wouldn't have the deleterious effects on society or on the environment. And what does it take to bring something like that about? Is that Is that where we are now, at the very, very lowest level of development in how to meet the needs of a society that is poisoning itself with so many things?
That in itself is such a controversial topic. Not so much that it's like, oh, my God, the world goes mad. But it is really, it does raise a lot of questions. See, for me personally, I am vegan. I do have a vegan diet. But I wouldn't consume something like that, not because I'm vegan, but because I know that meat doesn't sit well with me and my physical body.
Okay.
Like, just doesn't, for me, it might not be a different, for someone else, it might be a different answer. You know, for me, it's just based on my health. But for someone else, mm-hmm. they might raise the question, like, okay, well, what is going into the experimentation behind this? Is it sustainable, experimenting behind it so that we know that it's also not causing any background, direct change to temperature or the way we do things? So that, I don't know, maybe it might affect something else. And maybe it will affect the people making this in a lab. But also, too, I think about the fact that it's not really, it might be combating the problem, but sometimes people want so much of an alternative that's crystal clear the same, and it's not really, I don't know, it's like I said, it's very controversial. Some people are for it, some people are against it, some people think it's unethical, but I think we don't know all the details yet.
No, we don't. I mean, when I first heard about that, I'm saying, well, it's wonderful they're growing all these things. Do we ever run out of water? How do we grow them?
Exactly.
So there's such complexity here that it's very hard to, I think, for most people to grasp, including myself. And then I guess there were old standards. I'm very much older than you. I'm 69. There are old standards that people believed in years and years ago, and now a lot of that is being challenged. But people are just not, their mind is not so supple that they even want to consider an alternative, which I find the most frightening thing of all.
Funny because I had a conversation with someone, and we were discussing how people who are non-vegan view vegan food. And vegan food is food for anybody and everybody. But most of the time, a non-vegan will not eat vegan food just because it's vegan. And it's the strangest thing is because it's not set aside for one particular type of people. It's something that everyone can enjoy. But non-vegans won't touch it.
Well, that's what's so interesting, too. Well, I guess maybe that's part of the whole idea of what your diet used to be. I mean, I love garbanzo beans. I mean, I was brought up on chickpeas. I like falafel. I like all that stuff. But maybe it's a question of seasoning and how one looks at all these things. So it's very difficult to make a judgment call. But you would think that, people are eating vegetables, aren't they? Not everybody may like Brussels sprouts, but it's pretty good. Or maybe broccoli is more your speed.
They could probably do more, though. But, that also has a lot to do with, like, the physiological body and how we understand it. Because a lot of the time, we don't really understand our personal nutritional needs. And we overconsume. Whether it be in food or just in products that also, contribute to the topic, climate change. But it's definitely a consumerism thing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, very, very interesting. Yeah, before you go, can you tell us a little bit more about how did you get started with StayBlooming.com? What brought that about?
So, well, I like to write, and I always wanted to share my ideas, and I find that it's difficult to do that just using social media because you're very limited to your crowd of people that, you follow or follow you. So I decided to start my own platform so that I could share my own ideas. And with that, all my ideas, when I say that, it's really just limited to the environment and anything and anything and everything surrounding the cause. To keep people informed. Recently, I've completely devoted the website to talk about the environment, and have included a lot of resources, like information about organizations or events in New York City that people can go to that are green. And in the future, I'm looking to open up a shop that'll sell eco-friendly items so that people can see what kind of items they can or change to make these alternatives in their lives and help the environment. You know, because I really do believe that every little bit counts.
It does. You're right. It does. You're originally from the Bronx. Do you find going to the New York Botanical Gardens a real boon? Do you find that their attitude is changing as well?
I definitely enjoy the New York Botanical Garden. I love this, like, that the setting of being in the natural environment. So anything
right.
like that that's within the Bronx is it's really something to enjoy.
Oh, absolutely. Well, do you have any last minute words that we should cover that we haven't? You know, it's a big subject. I don't think we've exhausted
no,
it.
No,
for sure.
I think if there's anything that anyone listening would like to learn, you more than likely will find the information on my website, stayblooming.com.
Okay.
And if there are any questions someone might have about working with me or learning something, my email is Alyssa, A-L-Y-S-S-A, @stayblooming.com.
That's fantastic. Well, I want to thank you for making the time. It's certainly been a pleasure.
Yeah, and I also want to apologize for being a bit late. I'm actually going into surgery in a few minutes.
Oh, my. Well, I wish you a successful surgery.
Fine.
Good. And stay in touch. I think this is really wonderful. Maybe we can talk in the future about other issues that are specific to aspects of the environment. And, you know, there's just a lot of things
that
can be discussed. All the best.
Great.
Thank
that sounds good to me.
And
thank you so
recovery.
Much. Have a wonderful day. Thank
my
you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye. Exciting. Goodbye. Thanks so much. How exciting. So Alyssa Perez, and again, you want to learn a little bit more. She's got a fantastic website called stayblooming.com, and you can learn about a lot of the things that she writes about and just learn a great deal more than you may not have considered before. And that's very compelling. And hopefully you're flexible in your thinking and would consider just hearing possibly a different perspective on issues. And that's very, very compelling. Well, let's take a quick break, find out what's going on in the Yonkers Tribune, and then we'll be right back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Another number you could reach out to the Yonkers Tribune, should you care to, is 347-415-4326, 347-415-4326. This is really quite interesting on the international stage. It turns out the Einstein puzzle has been solved as missing pages have emerged. Now, this is really, really compelling. It seems an Albert Einstein puzzle has been solved thanks to a missing page of manuscript emerging in a collection of his writings acquired by Jerusalem's Hebrew University, officials announced today. The handwritten page, part of an appendix to a 1930 paper on the Nobel winner's efforts towards a unified field theory, was discovered among the 110-page trove the university's Albert Einstein archives received some 2 weeks ago. Now, most of the documents constitute handwritten mathematical calculations behind Einstein's scientific writings in the late 1940s. There are also letters that Einstein, born in Germany in 1879, wrote to collaborators, which deal with a range of scientific and personal issues, including one to his son, Hans Albert. Now, the 1935 letter to his son expresses concern about the rise of the Nazi Party in Germany. Nearly all of the documents had been known to researchers and available in the form of copies, sometimes better copies, sometimes of very poor copies, said Honach Gutfreund, a scientific advisor to the university's Einstein archives. Gutfreund, a physics professor and former president of the university, said the 8-page appendix of the 1930 Unified Theory paper had never been published, though researchers had copies of it. But in the copies we had, one page was missing, and that was a problem. That was a puzzle, Gutfreund told Agence France-Presse, and to our surprise, to our delight, that page is now here. It came with the new material, he said. Hebrew University said, quote, this article was one of many in Einstein's attempts to unify the forces of nature into one single theory, and he devoted the last 30 years of his life to this effort. The collection, acquired through a donation from the Crown Goodman Foundation in Chicago, was bought from Gary Berger, a North Carolina doctor who had a private collection of Einstein writings. Gutfreund refused to divulge the sum paid for the 110 pages. Einstein was one of a founding father of the Hebrew University and served as a non-resident governor of the Jerusalem Institution. When the German-born physicist died in 1955, he bequeathed the university his archives, with curator Ronnie Gross saying it's 82,000 items and make it the world's most extensive collection of Einstein documents. Now, saying all that, the bottom line is we don't know how the puzzle was solved. So that's going to be very, very interesting and very compelling. But it's interesting because now that one page was missing, and it is probably a greater extrapolation than something that was known before, we'll find out exactly where that leads and what transpires because of it. Now, there's some other stuff that's going on, certainly in our hemisphere. Venezuela's Guaido is backing a strike. He's telling Maduro the pressure is just beginning. So Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido vowed yesterday to step up the pressure on President Nicolas Maduro as he offered his backing to a potential public sector strike. 35-year-old National Assembly leader returned home to a hero's welcome on Monday, having defied a ban on leaving the country to embark on a 10-day tour of South American allies, and remains free after returning despite the threat of arrest by the government. They're drowning in contradictions. They don't know how to respond to Venezuela's people, Guaido told reporters. They thought the pressure had reached its zenith, but it's only just beginning. On Tuesday, the national holiday, he met a public sector union leaders, and he said public sector workers have lost practically all their rights. We have no other option but to call for a civic strike, said Guaido, without giving further details. Battered by an economic meltdown, Venezuela descended into a major political crisis when Guaido declared himself interim president. This was back in January, and asserted that Maduro was no longer legitimate. Recognized by more than 50 countries as Venezuela's acting president, Guaido flouted a government travel ban on February 22nd to head off and rally support for his bid to oust Maduro. When he returned to Caracas, the capital, his latest challenge to Maduro's authority, Guaido announced to tens of thousands of supporters a new demonstration this coming Saturday. Guaido has vowed to set up a traditional government and hold new elections. On Tuesday, U.S. Envoy Elliot Abrams said that given Maduro's low popularity, it would be a gift, quote unquote, if he decided to run in fresh polls. That's ultimately a decision for Venezuelans to make, Abrams said, as part of his challenge to Maduro. Guaido is attempting to take control of the state bureaucracy, which he considers to have been kidnapped, quote unquote, through blackmail and persecution. Now, unions from the oil industry, basic services, the public bank, and local government took part in Tuesday's meeting. Union leader Ana Yanez told Agence France-Presse, the public administration is practically paralyzed in the town halls. People only go to work 3 days a week, and even then, barely half the day, Yanez had said. Maduro finally made an appearance in the late afternoon to lead a military parade paying tribute to his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, on the sixth anniversary of the socialist firebrand's death. Now, standing in front of Chavez's mausoleum, Maduro also called on his supporters to take to the streets on Saturday to mark 4 years since then U.S. President Barack Obama first announced sanctions against the socialist government. Maduro has done this before, calling his own counter-demonstration every time Guaido announced a protest. Both attract thousands of supporters, but the opposition gatherings usually have the edge in numbers. And Maduro had been active on Twitter earlier in the day, again paying tribute to Chavez. Quote, thanks to your teachings and your example, we're continuing the permanent fight against those who tried to many times extinguish your voice, wrote Maduro. Now, during his travels, Guaido met U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and the leaders of Colombia, Brazil, Paraguay, Chile, and Ecuador. He crossed into Colombia on February 23rd to reach a bid to bring in humanitarian and stockpiled aid near the border, but the move was blocked by the military and security forces in a day of chaos and bloodshed. And Venezuela is racked by a humanitarian crisis that has seen poverty soar, with an estimated 2.7 million people leaving this country since 2015. It's absolutely mind-boggling how far things have gone berserk in Venezuela. And there's not much that sometimes people can do. They don't have options that one would think they would have. And I guess, and it's extremely difficult, you know. It's just very, very difficult, and it's tragic that this is happening, because this is not people's will, and the political platform has literally beaten the populace to the ground, which is absolutely mind-boggling, to say the least. Okay, well, let's just see what else is happening on the world stage. From Europe, we hear that Orbán is taking aim at pro-immigration Macron, after a European op-ed. So this is really quite interesting. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban reacted to French President Emmanuel Macron's op-ed on European reform by calling for a, quote, serious European debate, end quote, over what he considers the bloc's top issue, which is immigration. In an op-ed established, published for Tuesday's newspapers, throughout the bloc, Macron advised voters in the May 23 to 26 European Union Parliament elections to reject nationalist parties that offer nothing, quote unquote, laying down the battle lines for the vote. In an emailed statement to the Reuters news agency, Orban apparently welcomed Macron's call for talks on reforming the European Union. This could mark the beginning of a serious European debate. In the details, of course, we have differences of views, but far more important than these differing opinions is that this initiative be a good start to a serious and constructive dialogue on the future of Europe, said the Hungarian leader. But in another statement, Orban's office slammed the French leader for being a pro-immigration politician, quote-unquote, attacking those who are opposed to immigration. The Hungarian government said Macron believes immigration is good. We believe it is bad. Orban's office also accused Macron of censorship, claiming he called for the banning of posters of the opponents of immigration. In recent weeks, the Hungarian government has been waging a media campaign against European leaders and their supposedly pro-immigration position. Billboards and ads show European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker and Hungarian-American billionaire George Soros above the caption, "You too have the right to know what Brussels is planning to do." The media campaign against European Union leaders is fueling calls to exclude or suspend Orbán's party, the Fidesz, F-I-D-E-S-Z, from the European Parliament's main center-right group. Representatives from other right-wing political parties across the European Union are set to discuss the matter in a meeting of the European People's Party on March 20. So, very, very compelling. That's going to not be too far off. And so we're going to have to see where that goes. And this is going to be very interesting as well. Evidently, Macron's declaration of love is an awkward scoop for Italy's state TV. Aimed at healing a vicious spat between France and Italy, French President Emmanuel Macron's interview on Italian television has shed light on the battle waged by Italy's ruling populist parties for control of the country's state broadcaster. When Fabio Fazio announced he had landed an interview with French President Emmanuel Macron to be aired during his weekly talk show on Sunday, March 3rd, the popular presenter may surely have felt he deserved a bravissimo from his boss. A 25-minute interview with one of the world's foremost heads of state is a good catch at any time. Coming just weeks after Paris recalled its ambassador to Rome to protest at, quote, unfounded attacks and outlandish claims, end quote, by the Italian government, a move not seen since World War II, it was nothing short of a scoop. Instead, the primetime interview was met with an embarrassed silence at Italy's state broadcaster, RAI. RAI, that's the name of the broadcaster. It garnered one retweet from the @RAI1 Twitter account shortly before the show was aired, and none thereafter. Somehow, it was altogether omitted from the customary teaser that announces the program and its roster of guests. Macron was clearly the most important guest of the evening, said Carlo Baroni, a popular journalist at the Italian daily Il Corriere della Sera. To have left him out of the advertising spot is somewhat baffling. To understand why the interview was kept largely under wraps, one needs to look at the particular position Fazio occupies in Italy's media landscape, his relationship with managers appointed by Italy's dominant political parties, and the wider context of the bitter feud between France's Europhile president and Italy's populist Eurosceptic leaders. Well, a fixture of Italian television for the past three decades, Fazio presents one of RAI's flagship programs, C'è Tempo, C'è Fa, a three-hour-long mishmash of politics and entertainment that is distinctly more relaxed and urbane than its traditionally rowdy competitors. The show's general bonhomie are preserved by its soft-spoken presenter, a sharp and subtle mind wrapped in an affable, unassuming character. As the incorrigible Luciana Littizzetto, Fazio's in-house humorist, quipped during the program on Sunday, Fazio getting an interview with Macron was about as probable as me French kissing Bradley Cooper. But there is a good reason why the French president chose C'è Tempo, C'è Fa to reach out to Italian viewers. The program is a thorn in the side of Italy's government, a rare space where its two boisterous and ubiquitous strongmen, Deputy Prime Ministers Matteo Salvini and Luigi Di Maio, don't hold sway. Fazio is seen by the ruling parties as a relic of the left that was ousted from power, Baroni told Agence France-Presse, and by giving Salvini's and Di Maio's French nemesis a platform on Italian state TV, they believe he is dissing Italy and its government. According to Maurizio Boldrini, a veteran reporter who teaches journalism at the University of Siena, the controversy surrounding Macron's interview is a byproduct of the great tussle for control of the RAI that is currently underway. It's one of the great tragedies of this country that every change of government is promptly followed by an assault on RAI, Boldrini told Agence France-Presse. The ability to influence the state broadcaster, he added, became all the more vital in the 1990s once the owner of Italy's main private caster, Silvio Berlusconi, stepped onto or into the political arena. As per custom in Italy, where control of RAI's three main channels traditionally reflects political parties' respective weight in parliament, Salvini's hard-right Lega, L-E-G-A party, and Di Maio's anti-establishment five-star movement have sought to appoint like-minded managers to head the state broadcasters, most popular networks. In this battle for cultural hegemony, Salvini wants RAI to embrace a sovereignist, Italian's first platform, whereas the five-star movement favors a libertarian slant. Boldrini explains, adding that both camps see Fazio as embodying the old guard. So far, Fazio's sizable audience share has made him too big to fire. But the ruling parties have made no secret of their distaste for the presenter, fueling speculation that his program may be taken off the flagship RAI Uno channel. The standoff would explain why the channel's director, Teresa De Santis, seen as close to Salvini's Lega, was reportedly kept in the dark about the Macron interview until the presenter announced it in a tweet on Friday. The interview was clearly Fazio's initiative, said the Corriere's Baroni, adding that RAI managers' subsequent silence suggests, quote, they didn't agree with it, end quote. Now, news of the impending interview triggered a backlash at the weekend, spearheaded by the far-right Brothers of Italy party, which is allied with the anti-immigrant Lega in regional elections. Echoing recent attacks leveled at France by Salvini and Di Maio, Brothers of Italy leader Giorgia Meloni released a video in which she urged Fazio to, quote, hold Macron accountable for the neocolonial policies pursued by France in Africa, and to, quote, ask him why France won't allow African nations to develop, only to then lecture Italy because we are not welcoming enough people that are Africans. Meanwhile, the head of the party's parliamentary delegation said the presenter should go public about the cost of the interview at the Elysee Palace, claiming Italian citizens had, quote, the right to know how public services spend their money, end quote. As it turned out, Fazio, whose plump salary is a frequent, did just that, announcing at the start of the program on Sunday that he paid for what he paid, for the Paris trip out of his own pocket. Well, Fazio's critics, however, were right to suspect the French president would not be subject to a hard talk grilling. That is not the style of the show, whose presenter is not a press card-carrying journalist. Fazio is neither a political pundit nor an investigative reporter, Boldrini had pointed out. His segment is primarily infotainment, with the distinction that he strives to give his program a relatively high cultural level. The result was a relatively sedate interview, a cordial and at times intimate conversation that contrasted markedly with the barbs recently traded across the Alps. Adopting a conciliatory tone from the outset, Macron spoke at length of his love for Italy and its heritage, noting that the late Neapolitan author Eduardo De Filippo held a special place in his heart because he met his wife, Brigitte, while reciting one of his plays. He played down the violent verbal attacks from the Lega and five-star leaders as vicissitudes and made no mention of Di Maio's visit to yellow vest anti-government protesters in France last month, the incident that triggered the ambassador's recall. In a gesture to Italians, the French president admitted that European solidarity had been lacking while Italy and Greece bore the brunt of the recent migration crisis. He went on to quote another Neapolitan, Gomorrah, author Roberto Saviano, a fierce critic of Salvini's anti-migrant policies and rhetoric, in a thinly veiled jab at the Lega leader and his government. To the dismay of Macron's Italian foes, the French president was not quizzed about anything outstanding, sort of Franco-Italian commercial disputes. The far-left far-left activists Italy wants extradited from France, or the Libyan dossier that has poisoned relations between Paris and Rome. But neither did he seize the opportunity of a primetime slot on Italy's main television channel to chastise his political opponents in the country, whom he never once mentioned. Not that he needed to, by agreeing to sit down for an interview with their least favorite, the television presenter, and by quoting their fiercest critic, Saviano, Macron had already given Salvini and Di Maio a taste of their own medicine. You got to love the subtlety of European politics and backstabbing. It's just, you got to just love it. What can I tell you? Now, We didn't discuss this. We didn't have time before. Evidently, the Vatican is going to open secret archives of World War II era Pope in 2020. Pope Francis announced on Monday that the Vatican will open the secret archives of the wartime pontiff Pius XII in March of next year, which could shed light on why the Catholic Church failed to intervene more against the Holocaust. Researchers have long sought to examine the World War II era archives for what they consider the lack of strong action by Pius XII, who presided as the pontiff from 1939 to 1958 against the German Nazis over the massacre of Jews, an attitude denounced as a form of passive complicity. I decided that the opening of the Vatican archives for the pontificate of Pius XII would take place on March 2nd of 2020, the pontiff said. The date is the 81st anniversary of the election of Eugenio Pacelli to the papacy. The church is not afraid of history, added Francis, recalling that Pius XII found himself as head of the Roman Catholic Church, quote, at one of the saddest and darkest times of the 20th century, end quote. Francis said he made the decision understanding that serious historical research will evaluate, quote, in a fair light, with appropriate criticism, the moments of exaltation of this pope, and no doubt there are also moments of serious difficulties, tormenting decisions, and Christians and humane care. For many historians, Pope Pius XII could have condemned more forcefully the massacre of Jews by the Nazis, but he didn't do it out of diplomatic caution and in order not to put Catholics in danger in occupied Europe. Yad Vashem, the World Holocaust Remembrance Center in Jerusalem, said it commends, quote unquote, the decision, quote, which will enable objective and open research as well as comprehensive discourse on issues related to the conduct of the Vatican in particular and the Catholic Church in general during the Holocaust. It said it expects that researchers will be granted full access to all documents stored in the archives. In 2012, the center changed the caption of Pope Pius XII in its mausoleum, saying his reaction during the Holocaust continues to be a matter of controversy among scholars. The Vatican was officially neutral during the war. Other historians point out that Pius XII saved thousands of Italian Jews, tens of thousands of Italian Jews, by ordering convents to open their doors to take them in. According to Vatican Archives head Bishop Sergio Pagano, preparations to make the documents public began under Francis's predecessor Benedict XVI back in 2006. The Holy See hoped everyone would be ready by 2015, but the amount of documents and a lack of staff pushed that deadline back, he told Vatican newspaper L'Osservatore Romano. Now, Pagano said that the painstaking work of archiving a crucial period for the church and for the world will allow historians to discover a superhuman work of Christian humanism, quote unquote. And Francis said, in studying the archives, the wartime pope's decision may appear on some as reticence and were instead attempts to, quote, maintain in times of the deepest darkness and cruelty the small flame of humanitarian initiative of hidden but active diplomacy, end quote. In a 2014 interview with Argentine Pontiff turned the spotlight away from the Vatican, saying that the Allies had photographs of the railway routes that the trains took to the concentration camps. Tell me, why didn't they bomb them? And in a separate interview, he described how Pius XII hid Jews in the Castel Gandolfo summer palace, papal palace near Rome. There in the Pope's room on his very bed, 42 babies were born, Jewish children and of other persecuted who were sheltered there, he said. The perception of passivity was in part fostered by a play by German playwright Rolf Hochhuth in 1963, which was later adopted by Greek director Konstantin Costa-Gavras in the 2002 film Amen, which did much to damage Pope XII's image on the issue. While Pope John XXIII, from 1958 to 63, Pope Paul VI, from 1963 to 1978, and John Paul II, 1978 to 2005, had been made saints, the beatification of Pius XII, a necessary step on the path to Catholic sainthood, is still at a standstill due to the controversy surrounding his wartime papacy. Oh, my God. So we'll just have to see where all that goes. Well, it's time for us to depart. We got so much to do and so much to catch up on. So I want to thank you for being with us, that's for sure. And hopefully you'll join us once again. And join us tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to be speaking to John and Lori Wiles. Hopefully we'll be able to get a hold of Winston Morrow doing the Driving Me Crazy segment. Hopefully we'll hear from Mayor Richard Thomas from Mount Vernon. And I guess that's about it. I don't remember who else is on, but we'll write that up for you today. So all the best, and thank you.